Hi there, I'm Kelly Kluke for Coyote Radio and Advertising. This is the Cal Talks podcast series, and today with Miriam Fernandez. And she is Professor Department of English here at CSUSB and has so much to talk about today. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Where were you born and where did you grow up through high school? What was that like?
I was born in Guadalajara, Mexico. And I came to the U.S. when I was about 6 years old. I grew up in the Central Valley, so it was a really small farming community. It's called San Joaquin. Yeah. My high school was the town next to us, Tranquility High School. So we had to take the bus to go to the high school, which I always thought was really exciting.
San Joaquin Valley. I love mm-hmm. it. I worked in Bakersfield for a while. I loved it. I loved everything about it. And Bakersfield's kind of a big town as opposed to that, but it still felt small, and I liked that a lot. Now, did you go straight from high school into college?
I did, yeah. So I was always a really good student. It was always something that I was interested in. And so very early on, I think my teachers were always drilling this college. And it was, to me, like the opportunity to do better. So it was always something that I wanted to do. So I got accepted to UCLA when I was in high school. And that was a big thing because a lot of people said, well, you can't go there. That's dangerous. It's LA. So you could get kidnapped. You're going to get mugged. You know, my town was really small. Like our high school was 500 students total. My graduating class was 100. So for us, the idea of LA seemed really dangerous. But I had visited the campus and it was so beautiful, so sunny. And I just loved the energy. So I fought for that. I convinced my parents that was the best choice for me. They wanted me to go to Fresno State because then I could just drive to school and come back, which even then, that's like a 1 hour drive. So it's not, an easy drive. But they finally, they were like, okay, I guess we'll try this. And so I went to UCLA.
Congratulations on that. Please describe the rest of your educational path.
So I had a pretty traditional educational path. I know some people take some time off. I ended up really not taking any time off. So when I was at UCLA, my major was sociology, and I wanted to go into advertising. So, I thought that was a really good career. I think I had watched this movie with Jennifer Aniston, and she was an advertising exec. And I thought, wow, that looks like such a fun job, like, coming up with commercials, persuading people to buy things. And so that was my plan. But then, my parents were actually going through a divorce right when I was finishing my UCLA education. And so I thought, I'll just go back home and, just help them out, like be a support for them. So I moved back to Fresno right after I graduated. And for a little while, I was like, well, I don't know what I'm doing here. Job-wise, I was working at Olive Garden. Well, it's hard to find a job when you finish the school. So I was working at Olive Garden. I ended up getting a job at Fresno State. And then that gave me the idea, because I had a full-time employee at Fresno State, you get a tuition waiver. And I thought, well, maybe I should get a master's degree. And so they didn't, I don't think they had a master's in sociology at the time. So I thought, well, what's the next closest thing? And I thought, literature, because you're doing a lot of analysis of literary works. So I applied and I got into this master's program in literature. And it was actually a quite a bit of a challenge because in sociology, you write in a particular style. You do different kinds of analyses. And then when you're doing literature, it's a different form, right? So you kind of have to change your writing style. So that was really one of the first times that I became interested in how like different contexts call for different writing styles. So I was doing my master's in literature, and they also had in the English department, they also had a concentration in composition. And so I thought, I'll get a certificate in composition. I'm interested in the study of how we teach writing, how we learn writing. So I started teaching in their first year composition program I only had to teach like one class or two classes, I think, a semester. But I was also working like full time at I was working full time at Fresno State.
What were you doing? What was the job at Fresno State?
Oh, so I was an administrative assistant for the International Programs Office. Yeah, so I actually got to travel to Italy. Yeah, for free. I got to go for a week to check out one of our study abroad sites, which was really exciting. And then I got to come home and I got to tell students all about this, like the two sites that I had visited, and encourage them to go and you know, check that out. So once I started doing the composition certificate, that actually changed my trajectory. So I had first initially been thinking, well, literary studies. But once I started doing composition work, I was really interested in the teaching of writing. And so I decided to apply to a PhD program in rhetoric and composition at Washington State University. And that's kind of the beginning, I guess, of how I ended up where I am today.
West Coast all the way. What led you to CSUSB? How did you get this wonderful job? How'd you hear about it? How was that whole process?
So in 2017, that was my last year as a PhD student. I was finishing up my dissertation. And so that's around the time that you start going into the job market and you start looking, what are the jobs that are available? So the jobs usually appear about a year before you would start, right? So around October, or maybe it was September, all these job listings came up, and I started to look at, well, what's in the comp ret world? And one of the first jobs that I saw was CSUSB. And immediately I was like, this is the job that I want. Like, immediately, I knew it was the right one for me. Partly because they also, this university has a stretch program. So for first year composition, they offer, instead of having just the 1 year first year composition class, we also have a 1 year one, where you take one semester with the same teacher, and then the next semester you're taking the second part of the class. So it's stretched out over a year instead of one semester. And that's really helpful for students who struggle with writing or who feel insecure about writing, because they can take a little bit more time learning you know, all the things that you would learn in that one semester, but it's slower. And you have a little bit more community because you have the same students throughout the whole year, same professor and everything. So at Fresno State, we had a stretch program, and I loved teaching in the stretch program. And so when I saw that CSUSB was looking for someone in rhetoric and composition, and that they had a stretch program, I was like, well, this is a perfect fit for me. So there were a couple other jobs that also seemed like I might be a good fit for them too. So I applied to, I think, 10 jobs. I got two interviews. So I got an interview here at CSUSB and another at another CSU. But my heart was really in, like, I really want the CSUSB job. And I was hoping that they'd be the ones to make the first offer, because, you know, I wasn't really in a position where I would be like, oh, you're giving me an offer, let me hold on and think about this other place, right? And so luckily, right after my second job interview at this other CSU, CSUSB called. I think I was like in the airport on my way back, having just finished the campus visit for the other CSU, and they offered me the job, and I was like, yes, I will definitely work there.
You're just so enthusiastic about it. I love it. It just really shines.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your broad knowledge of your field, what would you say is your personal favorite area?
It's hard to pick one. You know, rhetoric and composition is at least advertised as one field, but it really is kind of two fields in one. So you have the rhetoric side, where you are more looking at how is it that people persuade, how is it that people are persuaded. And so that can take on really a broader kind of arena. Like, you could look at...
Can you give an example?
Sure. Like, you could look at political speeches, for example. You might also look at advertisings. Maybe look at a print advertisement and kind of break it down. How is it connecting to the audience? How is it sending a message? Or even a TV commercial. you could look at it from the standpoint of just regular communication between two people. So it's really rhetoric. You're breaking down a moment of communication and you're trying to see what is it that is working between the writer and the audience or the speaker and the audience. How is it that the audience is receiving that message? What makes that message successful, right? Because we oftentimes try to persuade people all the time, but we're not always successful.
Well, so this goes kind of into your advertising thing a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the rhetoric side. In composition, you're taking those ideas, but it's really comes down to how do we compose an essay or even like an audio essay, for example. So it's really thinking about how is it that a student writer or any writer, outside of the classroom as well, how is it that they can compose an argument, right? What are the different pieces to an argument? What pieces of evidence are going to be persuasive? How do you position your argument in a logical way? How do you add emotional impact to it? All of these different things. So composition is really the study of how we learn to write, how we teach writing. And that has, a more specific field, which is the classroom. But also, outside the classroom, it would be applicable as well.
On the same subject, but on teaching, what is your favorite course or courses to teach?
Well, definitely the first year composition class is one of my favorites. I think that that's where I have the most impact. I try to teach writing in a way that's nurturing and also exciting and challenging. And I feel that a lot of students who come into that first year composition class have this feeling of, I hate to write, I'm not a good writer, I don't see what's the purpose of this except to torture me. And so I like to take that space as a way of changing their minds and telling them, you are a good writer. You just have a different expertise in how you write, what genres you write in, right? But everybody writes, everybody composes something. And so it's kind of figuring out how do we tap into those composition skills that you have where you feel really good about it, and how do we translate that into the classroom space, which is probably a space where a lot of students don't feel very good about. So that's one of my favorites, just because I feel like I have the most impact. Another one that I really like, it's kind of a more recent one that I've been teaching, is the theories of public and professional writing. So I'm teaching that class now, and we kind of look at different theories, which really, in a sense, they're very interconnected, but they just kind of come in different subfields, right? So we're looking at public sphere theory, we're looking at rhetorical theory, we look at different communication theories, and we try to apply them to real scenarios. Like, how is it that if we're looking at one particular event in time, how can we see these theories play out? I've also taught writing in the public sphere. And so those two classes are kind of connected, right? They're both dealing with the public, and they're both dealing with rhetorical theory. So oftentimes, like, I have my students take some real event that has had great impact, and we kind of break it down into how is this functioning through the public sphere? How is this functioning rhetorically? And so we do a lot of those types of breakdowns.
When you said everybody can write, it reminds me of when I heard Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones say, people say I can't sing. He says, everyone can sing, just some better than others.
Yes, that's exactly true of writing.
So tell us about your interests and the research regarding the story and folklore of La Llorona.
So La Llorona is the story of a mother, right, who has lost her children, and she has become this haunting spirit. In the most common version is that she drowned her children as an act of revenge or grief because she has been left by her partner, her husband, or her lover. And so when she realizes what she has done, she goes mad with grief, and she becomes this haunting spirit that basically roams, any area looking for her children. And so if she happens upon a child, she might confuse them for her own children and take them away. So it was a story that I was told when I was pretty young. I think I was 4 or 5. And I remember looking outside at the window thinking, am I going to see her? But what if she sees me? So I had this it was an impactful story and something that was always kind of in the back of my mind, this idea of this woman spirit who was in grief looking for her children and this fear that she might find me, might see me, or that I might see her. And as I grew older, I started to think about, you know, why is it that we're so afraid of this figure? Obviously,
scary.
Yeah, she's scary, sure. But I also thought there's something about maternal grief that maybe makes her more frightening. And, you know, if we look at it from the literary side, if we're looking at it as a story, we write it down, you know, it's very patriarchal for sure. You know, it's this the punishing of a woman who rejects her maternal role. It's also a punishment of a woman who is perhaps overly sexual. In some stories, you know, she's seen as a seductress who seduces this man into falling for her. And then he sort of rejects her later. For someone that is more classy or more correct as a wife, perhaps. So there's definitely this aspect of punishing women who are not, you know, chaste or who are not good mothers. So I'm really interested in that aspect. But I think that in the actual storytelling, right, when we tell the story, it seems to me that it's more matriarchal, you know, that's it's typically told by mothers or grandmothers or aunts, also by men too. But most of the time, I think it's by women who are telling the story to their children. And sometimes other times it'll be children telling the story to their peers. So my study is looking at what are the different stories that people know. So I interview folks and I ask them to tell me what's the story they know, the version that they know, and they tell it to me. And I ask them about when they first heard that story, who told it to them, what was the context,
why?
Why, yeah, exactly. And also, when have they told the story again, if they have, right? So they tell me, you know, oh, I told the story to a friend, or I've never told the story again. So my study is looking at two sides of this. One, what is the purpose of storytellers when they first tell that story to whoever they're telling it? It seems to me, just based off of what I've interviewed, that oftentimes there's a protective aspect to it. It's this idea of, like, especially with older folks who were told the story when, you know, conditions were maybe a little bit more isolated, like there weren't a lot of neighbors, so they lived in an isolated area. There was like a river nearby. And so it was this idea of protection, of if you're afraid of this river, if you're afraid of this lake, you're not going to go there at night, right?
That makes sense. It really does.
Yeah. In other cases, it seems to be more entertainment, right, of like, oh, we don't have anything to do on this rainy night, so let's tell a scary story. And then in some cases, it seems like there's that, I really want to scare you. I'm going to torture you a little bit with this story.
You've been a bad kid, so
exactly.
Sit down.
Yeah, so sometimes it's used on misbehaving children as a way of saying, like, you need to behave or else La Llorona is going to come and get you. So that seems to be some of the things that I'm finding there. In the other side, which is the if you've been told the story, whether or not you tell it again, I'm finding some interesting things, especially for mothers. So the people I've interviewed who are mothers kind of break down into, I would never tell the story to my child because I don't want to scare them. And the other side is, I want to tell this story to my child because I want to keep this cultural aspect alive. So that's also really interesting.
When was the first recorded storytelling of this? When did it start being sort of documented?
Oh, that's hard to say.
Okay.
I mean, it's an oral story, so that's one of the reasons why it's hard to track. One of the first times that it was recorded in writing, I think, would have been in the early 1600s. And this was, so it's in the Florentine Codex. I don't know if you're familiar with the Florentine Codex, but it's a text that was written post-conquest in Mexico. I guess he's like a priest. So he was a priest, was really interested in the language of the Nahua, or the previously known as the Aztecs. And so he kind of took it upon himself to learn a lot about the language, to learn about the different traditions. And he basically wrote like 12 books with the Nahuas, right? So he had these young Nahua aides who helped him write. And so they wrote, one side was a Nahua, and then the priest wrote the other side in Spanish. So it was a Spanish translation. And they documented everything from like daily life to, you know, rituals. And also there's like book 6, I think, is all about speeches. So book 12 is more of the history of the conquest, of the moment in time when Hernan Cortez arrived and, you know, when he fought against the Mexica, or the Aztecs as we know them. And so in this book, the very beginning of book 12 starts off with 10 years before the arrival of the Spaniards. There were, I believe it's 6 omens, I think it's 6 or 8. There were 6 omens that foretold the coming conquest. And I think it's number 6. I think she's the last one. There was a woman who was crying out for her children. So it was, "Ay, mis hijos." And that's the call that La Llorona, you know, makes in traditional storytelling, traditional lore. So in the story, she knows that this conquest is coming. She knows that the people are going to suffer great losses. And so she's crying out for them in the middle of the night. And this is before the conquerors arrive. So that's the first recorded story. And it's not exactly what we know, right? Because we don't know much about who she was before. We just know that's this spirit woman who comes out at night and she's crying for her children and she's foretelling great losses. But that seems to be like an early iteration of La Llorona.
That is ancient history. I had no idea. Thank you. What do you like about working in the Inland Empire?
Well, I love the people. You know, I love my students. I get so much joy from working with them. They are some of the most dedicated students, most interested, right? Like, they just really love to learn. And I love my colleagues. You know, I have really great colleagues in the English department that I'm so happy that I get to work with. And that's really what it comes down to, is just the people.
We'll turn some personal stuff on you. What are your hobbies?
So I really only have one, one hobby, and that's bird watching. Yeah, so I'm a big bird watcher. You too? Yeah. It actually started around the pandemic. I had never really been interested in bird watching before, but you know, with the pandemic, it was, you really couldn't go anywhere except for maybe like, you know, parks, like some nature sites, right? So I would go hiking with my partner, and we had this app. It's called Seek, S-E-E-K, I think. And it, you know, you can put it on a flower and it'll tell you what kind of flower it is. But I didn't realize it could also tell you what kind of bird, right? So if you got close enough to a bird, you could seek it and find out what kind of bird it was. And so once I started to see like different types of birds, I got really into it. And so I got binoculars, I got a camera that has a really good zoom. And I just started going out as much as I could to any areas where you had some kind of quiet, natural space. And I started taking pictures of birds. So I even have a blog. It's called, I think the site is birdsview.blog. And I do, you know, posts where I just talk about like, oh, I went to this park and these are the birds that I saw. And it just, it's a lot of joy for me. Like, I don't think I got a lot of readers. I think I have like 3. It's like one of them is my sister. The other one's my partner. And I think the other one's like one of my high school teachers. So obviously it does not get a lot of visitors, but I just enjoy, you know, putting it out there and having a space where I can share some of my pictures Sometimes I even make calendars of my bird pictures, and I send it out to friends.
There's a movie with Jimmy Stewart, and it's Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation. And they're from the Midwest, and they go out to the California coast. From what it looks like, it's somewhere between the Central Coast and San Francisco. And he, one of his neighbors, they were vacationing there for the summer, is a bird watcher. And he'll go, look over there. What is that? Barn swallow. This is the expert. And they keep walking. He goes, what is that bird? Barn swallow. They come across this pond, and there's this beautiful egret. And he goes to Jimmy Stewart, do you know what kind of bird that is? Barn swallow? he keeps telling him. Just for me, just real quick, there's, I think it's a single mockingbird in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Goes from house to house. And I hate when he's sitting on my fence. I joke hate. But they're loud and they're incessant. Mm-hmm. And you know them for those long tails. Again, yeah. Those long tails.
They have a really pretty yellow eyes, too.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. They got their thing going on. I'm like, mockingbird, why don't you get your own song? You know? Let's move on to food. Everybody loves food. What's your favorite food and why?
I think my favorite food is probably pizza. It's the most easily accessible also. If it comes down to what's my favorite food that's not easily accessible, I would say pozole. I really only like my mom's, so it's like whenever she will make it, I'm like, yes, that's what I want. But I don't get to eat pozole very often, so it's hard for me to say that's my favorite.
Is there any place, you live in San Diego, is there any place in San Diego that you've had it that you can recommend for a restaurant?
Not a restaurant, but I live in Ocean Beach, and they have a farmer's market every Wednesday. I think it starts at 4 p.m. And there's a stand that's, I forget what it's called, but it says pozole on there, and that's all they sell is pozole. And that's one of my favorite places to go and get it. When my mom's not around.
Yeah, I was going to say, second to mom.
Exactly.
Okay. We've been speaking with Miriam Fernandez, professor in the Department of English here at Cal State San Bernardino. And finally, what do you want your students to take away with them after spending time in one of your classes?
I think that's easy. It's simply that there is real power in language. I think that we come to know the world around us through the words that we use. And I think that's a really important lesson. And I think once you figure that out, it's really fun to kind of break it down. How is it that the language this person is using is, you know, providing them power or taking power away from someone else? And I think once you can know that language has power, you can kind of start to see the ways that, you know, injustice or unequal relationships sometimes are founded on specific kinds of language. And if you know that, you can kind of counter that, I think.
We have had a great time here on the Cal Podcast Series with Miriam Fernandez in the English Department now. Professor, congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm Kelly Cloquet for Coyote Radio and Advertising, and thanks for listening.